This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie 13 Days, starring Kevin Costner, dramatizes the Cuban Missile Crisis, the most frightening crisis of the Cold War. Film critic Henry Sheehan will review the movie later. First, we're going to hear about the secret history of the crisis. It began in October of 1962 when the CIA learned that the Soviet Union had secretly moved nuclear missiles into Cuba. President Kennedy and his aides first considered the possibility of airstrikes on the missile sites, but decided instead to begin a naval blockade of Cuba. We knew America and the Soviet Union came close to nuclear war that October, but we didn't realize how close until the early 90s when secret documents from the crisis, including letters by Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro, were made public. This was largely the result of a six-year-long Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the National Security Archive. Tom Blanton, the director of the archive, collected the documents in a book that was published in 1992. I spoke with him then and asked, how close did we come to nuclear war?
The new documents on the Cuban Missile Crisis show that we were much, much closer to a nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States than even the decision makers at the time thought. And the key to this has been the revelations from the Soviet side that they had tactical nuclear warheads in Cuba, and that if the United States had invaded Cuba to take out the missile sites for the larger ballistic missiles, the local Soviet commanders would have used those tactical nukes. And as Robert McNamara, Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, said, what would have been the result? Well, the Americans would have responded in kind, and the end would have been utter disaster.
When you say the local Soviet commanders had...
In Cuba.
So it wasn't even Khrushchev's call, it was just local commanders'
exactly.
call.
Exactly. And I think that is the real point of what all these new documents have come to, and what all the former officials on both sides have now realized, which is one of the reasons that it got so dangerous was because it was, in a sense, out of control. From the United States side, we interpreted everything that happened in Cuba as a direct line to the Kremlin. We had a very exaggerated notion of the centralized control on their side, so that if they shot down a reconnaissance plane, which they did at the height of the crisis in Washington, President Kennedy and his advisors thought that must have been ordered by the Kremlin. And from the Kremlin side, they thought that everything we did was ordered by Washington. So when the Strategic Air Command went on its second highest level of alert, I mean, the highest level is war, the Strategic Air Command general did it in an open channel. And the Soviets thought, oh, Kennedy must have ordered that. They're about to go to war. This is a classic case of why crisis management is such a myth, that we now find out things were spiraling out of control. And if there's one underlying psychological dynamic that brought the settlement about, I think it was the realization by both Khrushchev and Kennedy that they didn't have so much control as they had thought.
So had we invaded Cuba, we probably would have been under nuclear attack. How close did we come to invading Cuba? Is there new information about that in the recently declassified documents?
Well, there's a conflict between the among the president's advisors in their ex post facto reconstruction of the crisis. Secretary McNamara and the National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy both say that President Kennedy would have cut a deal and stopped short of an invasion. But if you look at the military plans, the CIA plans, all the things that were really underway, and put yourself in the shoes of the Cubans or the Soviets, they foresaw an invasion coming long before the missiles actually got to Cuba. It's one of the reasons they put them there. And they were in a position where they had a lot of incentives to do some preemptive action. So we came very close in the sense that neither side was in control anymore, in the sense of centralized control, and that there were tactical nukes on the ground. But I think that Bundy may have a point that both Khrushchev and Kennedy were very scared of any such final military action. But for the first few days of the crisis, a military invasion was what was the first item on pretty much most of the American advisors' list, including Bobby Kennedy's.
Who are the people in the administration that argued most forcefully for invading Cuba to get rid of the Soviet missiles.
Well, there's this wonderful story about how the Kennedy administration brought in some of the old wise men to advise them in this hour of crisis. One of those was Dean Acheson, who had been Secretary of State under Harry Truman and one of the architects of the whole containment policy against the Soviet Union. Supposedly, Acheson said at one of these high-level meetings of what was known as the XCOM, the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, just the closest top advisors, Acheson said, "Well, of course we got to take them out." And somebody asked him, "Well, Mr. Acheson, how would the Soviets respond to that?" And Acheson said, "Well, I suppose they'd have to take out our missiles in Turkey." And then the person said, "Well, what will we have to do in response to that?" He said, "Oh, well, to support our NATO alliance and back up our ally Turkey, we'd probably have to attack some of the Soviet missiles maybe in the Soviet Union." And the person said, "Well, what happens then?" And Acheson said, "Well, hopefully by then cooler heads would prevail." Which sort of made the bigger point that we all needed the cooler heads to prevail from the start as opposed to at the finish.
Is there a new understanding as a result of these documents of the Soviet motives for bringing missiles into Cuba in the first place?
I think that's those are some of the most extraordinary revelations, because as a result of a six-year-long Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, we at the National Security Archive finally forced the State Department in January of this year to release Khrushchev's own letters to Kennedy and Kennedy's responses. A few of those had been released previously, but the government was still withholding these on the grounds that it was sensitive foreign government information. A key advisor to our whole project, a professor at American University, Phil Brenner, had the idea of just going to the new Russian government and getting a little diplomatic note from them saying, "Hey, we wouldn't mind if those letters came out." And between that note and our lawsuit, State Department finally released. And now we have these extraordinary missives, some of them obviously personally written or dictated by Khrushchev, just because of the emotional content and the very personalized appeals that he makes. There's one really extraordinary one on October 26th to President Kennedy that has a really amazing plea from Khrushchev that puts very strongly the Soviet claim that they weren't taking the offensive by putting these missiles in Cuba. From their point of view, these missiles were defensive. They were simply a match for the fact that the U.S. had missiles in Turkey. Supposedly, at one point, Khrushchev was walking around in his garden at his dacha on the Black Sea and with some foreigner and pointed across the Black Sea to Turkey and said, "There are U.S. missiles over there right now pointing right at us, right at this garden." So, in a sense, one of their motives had to be giving the Americans a little taste of their own psychological medicine. But here's Khrushchev's words to Kennedy, and I think it's a remarkable statement, and you can read this fellow's personality, and I think that's the most amazing thing about these new releases. Here's what he said. This is in the middle of this letter on October 26. He said, "But Mr. President, do you really seriously think that Cuba could launch an offensive upon the United States and that even we, together with Cuba, could advance against you from Cuban territory? Do you really think so? How can that be? We do not understand. Surely there has not been any such new development military strategy that would lead one to believe that it is possible to advance that way. And I mean advance, not destroy. For those who destroy are barbarians, people who have lost their sanity. We are sane people. We do understand and assess the situation correctly. How could we then allow the wrong actions which you ascribe to us? Only lunatics or suicides, who themselves want to perish and before they die destroy the world, could do this. But we want to live, and by no means do we want to destroy your country. We want something quite different, to compete with your country in a peaceful endeavor."
How much do you trust those sentiments?
Clearly they're self-serving, because Khrushchev is attempting to persuade Kennedy not to back off of these harsh actions. Kennedy had announced a quarantine. He had accused the Soviet Union of outright deception, of lying directly to him. And in fact, Kennedy was correct. The Soviets had lied directly to the U.S. about the placement of these missiles in Cuba. And I think in a strange way, Castro said he had urged Khrushchev to put the missiles there in not in secrecy, because if he did it openly, the U.S. would be faced with an open international parallel. You've got missiles in Turkey, we're going to put missiles in Cuba. But to do it in secret opened yourself up to exactly the accusation that Kennedy made, the bad faith. It was a major, if you will, a psychological blow for Kennedy to be able to make that accusation and have it stick.
Did you feel like you learned anything new about how frightened people in the Kennedy administration were about the possibility of nuclear war?
Very much so. There's an extraordinary quote from, for instance, Dean Rusk, who was the Secretary of State at the time when the U.S. had set up the quarantine line to keep the Soviet ships from steaming to Cuba with more missiles and supplies. Kennedy announced the quarantine. The Navy went out there. A bunch of Soviet freighters were on their way. And then the first ones stopped dead in the water. And Rusk is said to have said, "We were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other fellow just blinked." There was this sense of crisis. McNamara said, one of the mornings of the crisis, I think it was the morning of October 28th, after the U-2 pilot had been shot down over Cuba, and the Americans interpreted that as an order from the Kremlin to escalate this thing. When McNamara woke up, he said, he looked around and he was amazed because he was still alive.
My guest is Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis with Tom Blanton, the head of the National Security Archive. How do these newly released documents revise our understanding of how the missile crisis was ended?
Publicly, the story that we heard was Khrushchev backed down, he's pulling the missiles out, and Kennedy is saying, look, we've got no intention to invade Cuba as long as we can verify that there aren't these missiles there. What we now know from the documents and the interviews that these documents have generated with former officials is that Bobby Kennedy carried a secret message to the Soviets saying, look, really, we're willing to take the Jupiter missiles out of Turkey that you're so worried about, but we can't do it publicly because it undermines a NATO ally. But we can assure you that early next year, we'll go ahead and take them out because they're obsolete anyway. And so there was a classic secret diplomatic negotiation that the American public was never told about, but that was the underlying factor in Khrushchev, I think, being willing to accept a deal, back down, and lose face. Afterwards, Khrushchev wrote a long letter to Castro, which is a fascinating postmortem on just what Khrushchev thought had occurred. Castro felt sold out by Khrushchev because Khrushchev had backed down.
Also, didn't Khrushchev not bother to consult Castro before reaching this agreement?
Exactly. And Castro at one point sent a very hot-headed letter to Khrushchev when Castro thought the U.S. was about to invade in the middle of the crisis. And the text of the letter sounds almost like Castro is saying, use them or lose them.
Well, actually, let me quote from that. Castro wrote, if they actually carry out the brutal act of invading Cuba in violation of all international law and morality, that would be the moment to eliminate such danger forever through an act of clear, legitimate defense, however harsh and terrible the solution would be.
That's right. And there you see some of the problem about using the word defensive weapons, because Castro is saying if U.S. invades, that is, with conventional weapons, use the nuclear weapons, which would clearly be a major escalation. And yet, it's a good thing that the invasion didn't happen. It's a very good thing that those tactical nukes weren't used. And it's a very good thing the nuclear exchange didn't happen. But it wasn't skill in crisis management, and it wasn't brinksmanship, eyeball to eyeball. It was luck in many respects and a secret diplomatic deal.
But isn't the secret diplomatic deal part of the brinksmanship and skill?
No, because I think the lesson of brinksmanship is you can play chicken with the other guys. And in fact, we didn't play chicken with the other guys. In fact, we offered them a secret deal under the table and didn't tell the public about it so they could go back to their hardliners and say, look, we achieved something. In public, it looked like we were playing chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of scholars and policymakers ever since have said the lesson of the missile crisis is be tough and be strong. And if you draw that kind of lesson, then what you need to do with your military policy is talk tough, have a lot more guns than the other guy, and go eyeball to eyeball with him, and he'll blink. In fact, that's not the real story of the missile crisis. The real story is find out a deal that the other guy would accept that would help him save face and give him some of what he wants and get out of the crisis through a diplomatic negotiation, not brinksmanship.
Something else that emerges from these formerly classified documents is that Kennedy didn't want a settlement that would compromise the United States' efforts to overthrow Castro.
That's the most remarkable, I think, of the brand new documents just released this year under this Freedom of Information lawsuit that we brought against State Department. And that is Kennedy's letters right at the time that Khrushchev backed down seemed to make an almost explicit pledge that the United States would no longer consider an invasion of Cuba. And what we see after October 28th, when Khrushchev backed down, is a watering down of that pledge, and now we have a lot of the internal documents about why. And we have some of these State Department documents and studies that say, look, let's put real strong conditions on any no-invasion pledge. Let's say we'll only pledge if we can get UN verification that there are no more missiles there. Well, of course, I think they knew that the Cubans would never allow such a thing. What a violation of national sovereignty, etc. So they put conditions on that they thought wouldn't be fulfilled, and that way, and some of these documents say explicitly, that way we keep the option open for doing whatever we need to do in the future about Castro. And ultimately, by November 20th, and that's the one of the other pieces of news out of these documents, that the crisis wasn't just 13 days. They called it 13 days because that allowed it to end right before the midterm congressional elections that year, and the Kennedys were nothing if they weren't political and very politically astute. So they declared the crisis over. In fact, though, tensions continued on well into November over the remaining Soviet bombers and other nuclear-capable items in Cuba, and it wasn't until November 20th that the crisis really ended. And the crisis ended without any firm, unconditioned pledge from the U.S. In essence, Khrushchev backed off. He got a highly conditioned pledge, which said verification and these other, and Cuba can't take aggressive action in the hemisphere. So Khrushchev didn't get nearly what he thought he was getting. The U.S. kept its options open to continue to go after Castro, which they did. But the Jupiters did ultimately come out of Turkey.
Now, this new book on the Cuban Missile Crisis includes letters between Kennedy and Khrushchev, between Khrushchev and Castro. And I just found myself amazed as I was reading these letters to think that in the middle of this crisis that could have easily led to nuclear war, that Kennedy and Khrushchev were writing letters to each other. I mean, and what, mailing them airmail?
Well, some of them came through teletype. Some of them came cable. But that's one of the most fun stories. I think the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin, at one point said that it was the most remarkable sort of Stone Age communication because they would get their cable in code, translate it from code into Russian or English, call a messenger who would ride up on a bicycle to the Soviet embassy, give it to the messenger. The bicyclist would, you know, head down 16th Street to the White House, deliver the letter. That's this whole little episode and some of the 8-hour delays in getting letters through led to two things. One, when Khrushchev made his proposal to withdraw the missiles, he did it over the radio so there wouldn't be any delay. And second, they installed what became known as the hotline.
Oh, I see. The hotline wasn't installed till afterwards.
Exactly. How dangerous to have an 8-hour lapse at a time in which you got anti-aircraft batteries shooting down planes and invasion forces massing and ships coming head-to-head in the Caribbean. And just what a notion that you could have these letters being slowly teletyped out and handed by bicycle messengers.
Absolutely. I know. And then you know, the hotline became such an important part of Cold War iconography.
Exactly.
In the 60s.
But it was a very smart thing. I mean, that you could have that kind of direct communication.
Do you question the government's motives for keeping these documents classified for so long?
I do question their motives in the sense that I think it was bureaucratic inertia, certainly, that keeps this stuff classified for 30 years, but it's also the precedent that is set. We argued that they should release this stuff because no other event of the Cold War shaped our whole nuclear policy and our interpretation of Soviet intentions more than the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, that really fed, I would argue, a lot of the Vietnam syndrome, the sense that you had to be tough with the Russians and they would back down. You had to go eyeball to eyeball, and I think that's sort of what we tried to do in Vietnam, and it was a failure. So I think we see the government's motivations in this as protecting their own ability to make the decisions without criticism and without input from outside. There's a bureaucratic tendency to sort of cover your rear and not have your mistakes exposed to the public. And the other excuse they gave was if they released this, they'd be violating the communications with a foreign government. Well, so it really helped when the Russian government said, hey, we should release this.
Well, Tom Blanton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Blanton recorded in 1992 after he edited a book collecting the secret documents of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's the director of the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.